somewhere in Mumbai is my life pre-40 in a go-down somewhere. And I don't know if I ever want to check in with it again. Remember that movie George Clooney, Up in the Air? So I'm like that guy, but happy. I live in a profession that is so much based on validation. At some point, to stay mentally healthy, you have to pick what validation means the world to you. We were slowly gravitating towards the realization that you are not special because you are popular. Stand-up comedy and telling jokes are two very different things often as well. When you really understand what my art form is, you'll understand that, bro, I'm just experiencing the story the same way you're experiencing. In a slightly more professional way. I was born on a stage. I really was. Ever since I was 3.5 years old, if you put me on a stage, I'm home.
Veer Das is many things. But more than anything, he's someone who's sharing his inner experiences to the world and observing the world in its purest form. We're tapping into that in my conversation with him today. But before you go there, I want to make sure you hit subscribe, smash that bell icon, go straight into my chat with Veer. I'm so happy we're doing this because for the longest time, I started watching you as someone I would come to your shows and I would watch you do stand-up. And I remember I used to get, me and my mom used to come for amateur nights.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah.
So we're both old is the official confirmation.
We would come and sit in on that. Not as my thing. Like she would come to Bombay and I couldn't afford too many things. And I was like, let's take you for this. Yeah. And she and I would come for that. And over the years, our paths have crossed and we met. But I've always been intrigued by how your mind works. Because I find it to be supremely unique in the way it functions. And
by the way, just to infuse some humor, which is my defense mechanism at all times. If you came to my amateur night wearing that shirt and sitting with like that poise, you would terrify the comedian. You know what I mean? Because you just look like so zen. Like we'd be watching you from backstage going, he's not going to laugh. And then you'd laugh and we'd be happy. But you know.
Those days, I did not sit like this. Neither did my... Yeah. I think I'm a lot calmer. Like I said, you've gotten older, you get calmer.
Yeah, you got Zen vibes, man. You got like a monk who will buy a Ferrari or sold a Ferrari. One of them, you know.
Yeah. I don't think I'll ever buy a Ferrari. It's one of those things. Actually, that's an interesting one. It's a random way to start. But have you ever looked at saying, these are things I want in life for me to just call it a day?
I have a rule that I set with my wife and I followed it and she bailed in like 2 months. But the rule was we were going for a world tour and I'm like, okay, I'm doing 25 countries and this will be like 150 shows. Let's not do check-in luggage. So I have 5 t-shirts. I have like 8 pairs of underwear. I have 2 sweaters. One is like a workout sweatshirt. One is a sweater. I have these shoes, I have workout shoes, and I have a warmer jacket, and I have a denim jacket. And those Levi's, so they'll send me a jacket if I ever need one, somewhere. And these are all the clothes I have in the world. Let's see if we can do all these countries with just these clothes. Any amount of money on travel, hospitality, music, food, experiences. So let's fly first. Let's stay in a great hotel. Let's find one of the best restaurants in town. Let's spend the money. Let's get front row seats. But we're not buying jeans. You know, we're not going shopping. We're not buying some luggage or, you know, anything like that. She made it for a bit. And then, you know, women like to shop and have souvenirs and collect things. And I wouldn't begrudge her that. But I kind of stuck with it. And it has been extremely liberating. Like 90% of the clothes that I wear, I don't own ever.
So I've actually battled with this for a long time. Mm-hmm. Like I enjoy having things. More clothes and more shoes. And I have this cupboard full of things. And I remember when we got our house and, you know, when you finally have this moment when you can afford to buy a house in Bombay, it's a thing. And the question my wife Pooja had was, what do you want? And I said, I want a closet for sneakers.
Sure.
It was just a thing. I'm like, I, always in life, I'd wanted one closet just for shoes. I don't know why that was a thing for me. And it's a very random thing to ask for. It's not like I have so many sneakers, but I just wanted that.
Yeah.
But most days I come here to record and I just wear chappals and I'm coming in and...
Well, it also, I think as life has other plans, you'll learn from those. When life slaps you around a little bit, that's a teacher, right? Like for us, we had an elderly dog, and in the pandemic, we moved to Goa just for the dog, you know, because we're like, he's not gonna last in Mumbai. I need to give him a better, like, last year of his life or last year and a half of his life. And so we went to Goa, and we left, like, there was a little window where lockdown opened and a little bit of travel was eased. We bailed, right? And so we just got in an Innova, and with everything that we could fit in an Innova, we drove down to Goa. And my wife and my dog got priority on how much stuff we could carry. So I literally had space for that one suitcase, and this is the shit that I packed. And I was in Goa for 2 years, and I haven't left Goa yet. You know, now I go back and forth, but I was like, oh shit, I only need this. You know, this is all that I really need. So we had a house in Mumbai that we didn't take with us because the Goa house was furnished. And we shut down the house in Mumbai. I no longer have a house in Mumbai. And we put it into storage. But somewhere in my life is, somewhere in Mumbai is my life pre-40 in a go down somewhere. And I don't know if I ever want to check in with it again.
It's this thing, right? I feel we collect so many things and we fill our houses with them. Two things, right? You collect stuff in your head through what you experience in life and those you carry with you in different ways. And there's also physical things you collect and you keep them around. And then you're like, I can't move because there's so many things. It's a question, I think. And because also you accumulate them, because initially you don't have them, you want them. I call it the add to cart syndrome. I didn't have a better term for it, because you add stuff to cart when you think that's what gives you the feeling. And then once you actually buy it, you don't really care about half the things you buy.
Yeah, but if you've ever been in and out of an airport in under 6 minutes, like, that is better than, you know, any amount of things that you can, especially like in my world where a lot of my world is airports, you know. So I'm like that. Remember that movie George Clooney, Up in the Air? So I'm like that guy, but happy. I'm happy, you know, like I get through an airport pretty quick.
I want to go to the stuff you accumulate in your head, which is the other part, right? Is that when I see your special, when I've seen you on stage, it's often you're picking instances that everyone relates to,
sure,
but is yet deeply personal to you.
Yeah.
How do you find that line? How do you find the way to balance that?
I don't. People will tell you when it's deeply personal to them. I don't think you can really predict, you know. Comedy is very much like throwing darts at a dartboard without knowing how to play darts. You know, where you never know really what's going to hit. And roads that you never thought you'd go down, like I'll write a bit and I'll be like, oh, they're really going to connect with this. And then that flies by and suddenly this one random thing gets a laugh. And you're like, okay, now I need to go down this road. So I don't think you get to predict when people connect with something that you say. Your best bet is to authentically put it out there. And when I say authentically put it out there, it doesn't have to be true, because 99.9% of comedy begins with the truth and then heads to something completely false and outrageous. But if you are authentic while putting it out there, I think that's a connection, you know. So I'll talk about anything in my life, but I will make sure that I experience it authentically.
And being authentic is also a tricky thing, right? Because especially in the world we occupy today, because you see it in two dimensions, and most times you see it in a feed, you see it somewhere else, and then it's how you experience it. And sometimes that's so easily flipped for everybody else, because you start perceiving your life the way you are seeing it on social media.
Yeah.
And that happens to so many people.
Yeah.
On the other end of the spectrum, what you're also kind of, you're saying, I have to be authentic, so I'm sharing stuff, I'm being vulnerable as well, but you don't necessarily have to share everything. So we're in this weird scenario of...
Well, I live in a profession that is so much based on validation, right, from people. And at some point, to stay mentally healthy, you have to pick what validation means the world to you. And so I'm like, okay, if you paid money to come and see me, if you got a babysitter that night, if you could afford this row of tickets, but you saved up a little bit, you know, and you got the road right ahead of you, your validation means the very world to me. And your response means the very world to me. And I will let you dictate how I live my life in a certain sense. But sometimes the online machine and the online bubble, trying to impress that bubble, trying to please that bubble, is often the antithesis of the validation that actually matters. I think I read a really good comedian's quote where he was like, if there's somebody who's paying to see you, and some random guy who is never going to come to see you online has diluted your mind by even 5%, given you a bad day, so that you are at 95%, not 100% for the guy who paid money to come and see you, you are unprofessional. You're not doing your job. It's your job to be mentally healthy for the guy who came in and he's like, I mean, I don't say this with any arrogance, but it is very important to me that you understand when you come to a Veerdas show, you will be sent home flying on a cloud. Like that is the experience that I offer unapologetically. You know, I put you first. So whatever your problems are, you enter my auditorium and they don't exist anymore. And you will not remember them until you leave the auditorium. That is profoundly my job, you know. So if I come out there and I'm like, man, you know, I was on Instagram today and my reel didn't get, you'd be like, what? You know, I came from Indore for this. You know, so that's kind of how I feel about it.
That's an interesting case of A, setting, it's not just priorities. I feel it's what you just said is about saying you need to realize what is real and what really has impact and what doesn't. Because a reel is just something you flip through and you finish that off. But last year for me was a weird way of realizing the value of in person.
Yeah.
Because I feel we lost that for a few years. We thought, okay, everything's going to, I think the world thought, right? Everything's going to be online and, you know, we'll be moving that way. In person is gone. Physical shows, physical meetings.
Yeah.
Just like meeting someone who you talk to on a regular basis, maybe speak to once a week in person. See, I talk to them every day now online.
Yeah. Right?
I think last year was a point when all of us turned around and said, no, this is, I mean, the core of human existence, right, is that we connect in person.
Yeah, and I also think we were slowly gravitating towards the realization that you are not special because you are popular. Do you know what I mean? And that there is more value in being special than there is in being popular. Like, it's a very douchey celeb thing to say, but like, I did an ad, right, for a brand, and we put it up on Instagram and it got some 1.8 million views, which as a paid partnership is unusual. You know, ads don't really get that much views because on Instagram people are like, I know, and they move on, right? And so then your management calls in like, bro, like about 1.7 or 1.6 million views on an ad, the brand is super thrilled. And I'm like, yeah, but like I saw, you know, a guy sit down on a shit pot and then there was a frog in the shit pot and the guy flew off the pot and that had like 26 million views, you know. So it really, who gives a f-? At some level, who cares? It's not special. It's just popular.
Do you also feel that's what differentiates how everyone should look at, I mean, creativity is a loaded word.
Yeah, very loaded, yeah.
But I prefer the word artist because I feel there's something to it. Is that...
Man, that's an equally loaded word as well. You know?
I'm trying to find a word that's not loaded there.
Like,
let's just put a broad... I'll use the word creator word. Maybe the creator word is simple.
Yeah, creator is a... I mean...
Generic as you
yeah,
can get.
Like that's, to me, that's an insult. Like, I'm a creator. Really? What universes have you made? Did you create a planet? Did you create an ecosystem? What did you create? No, I made a reel about a shit pot. No, that's... so, I don't know. Let's say... artist. We can go with artist.
You make things.
We make things.
We make things. And we're in this world where everybody's making things now. Some yeah. with frogs coming out of shit pots.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And I do this unique thing, which is not, I don't think it's unique, but I think it's unique in my life, is that I sit with my 5.5 year old and every day she gets 15 minutes of what she calls big people videos, which is Instagram reels,
yeah,
basically. So you scroll through, and I'm always intrigued to see which one she wants to watch again. And they end up being the ones where there's someone, like today morning, it was like someone was making a pot. It was pottery.
Hmm.
And she said, I want to watch that again. Or when someone's doing art, or like someone's making a dessert. And I'm like, at the end of the day, as much as that shit pot and frog might get the views, it's someone who's actually creating, doing something that in an age-old way has...
I will watch anything that, you know, there's a... Excuse me, there's a genre of video called satisfying videos, which is like somebody putting their hand into jelly, you know what I mean? Or like sand, and then somebody's making a pattern in the sand. Dude, I'll watch that shit all day. And then I'll watch like dog rescue videos, but I'll skip through the suffering of the dog, right? So it'd be like, you know, Johnny was found something, something. And then I'm just be like, shh, Johnny's okay, you know? So I'll skip to the part where Johnny's okay. But those satisfying videos, then the videos where some big metal clamp breaks shit, I'll watch that all day long. But no, I'm not watching many people's Maldives vacation reels. That's not my vibe.
Let's not even go there. Yeah. I'm that person who did that once.
Oh, you made a Maldives reel?
So I made a Maldives reel about surfing.
So your Zen pose just went by. You're like, I have a Maldives.
I was like, yes. Yeah. I was like, so I had this age-old thing that I wanted to learn how to surf.
Same.
Sometime in life. And so we end up in this resort, and you suddenly realize it's a 3-hour flight from Bombay, and you're like, let's try that. And we go there, and the resort had a surf club. And I'm not a diver. I can't deal with, I just feel very like, why am I underwater? What if this tank goes away? Can I find something to hold? Is literally my response when I dive. So this, I find this really fun instructor who has the best story.
Hmm.
My surfing instructor was a guy who used to be the stage manager for Elton John.
Oh, nice.
And I think at some point he did the Rolling Stones. He did all of that. He did that for 15 odd years. Quit that to become a surf instructor. Saying, I wanted to go to a life that was more chill and relaxed. And he would do the Shaka Sign, and he would do that. And so he said, I need you. And I had a GoPro for whatever reason people have GoPros. And he said, why don't you just shoot you learning how to surf? And half the time I'm falling flat on my face. So I come back home like, that's a video. And one of the first responses on someone saying, hey, learn how to surf first before you put this video up. I'm like, that is the fun, that you're falling on your face.
Can you are you still surfing wash, or can you surf a wave now?
I went to the waves. I think I ended up surfing one wave or two waves out of about 20, which I fell on my face. So I've kind of like, I'm still not surfing. I call it me being able to stand.
Yeah, sure.
That is what I call it.
I mean, what a... The thing about surfing, it's very profound in that sense, is that you only catch one of every 40 waves that comes your way. And the toughest part of surfing isn't the ride. It's getting out beyond the rough, right? And that's exhausting. So a lot of people, it's very profound for life almost. A lot of people don't realize that by the time you catch a big wave, you're goddamn exhausted because you've pedaled against the tide for so long while surfing.
And you're also going against, you know, it's like this battle with nature of sorts, where once you let it capture you and let you flow is when you actually go. And then you have to make that trip back to that point, which is always the tough one. You're on that board. You're like, can I get back to the point?
I learned in Bali how to surf, and I did like a 10-day course. And then after that, I've surfed ever since. But I remember somebody took me out, maybe in Australia or something like that. And they're like, can you surf? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, but can you surf? And I'm like, yeah, I'm sure. And he's like, well, then head out. I'm like, you're not going to come with me? He's like, no, go on. And I forget where it was, maybe Melbourne or something like that, or Sydney. But really high waves with a sudden dip, right? So if you're not used to using a short board, which is really the only thing that rides such a high wave, you're properly screwed. So I fell ahead of my board and spent a good like 30 seconds at the bottom of the ocean floor, just in a spiral of that wave. And then you realize, oh, this is really, you know, you really do need to know how to swim. You really do need to know how to be calm underwater. And luckily you could see underwater, and I could see the shore above me. But had that been like a Goa beach or something where it's slightly murkier water, I would have panicked for sure, you know.
I equate surfing to life. I feel it's always that, like, you know, you're pulling yourself back to that wave. You ride, you have that brief moment of satisfaction when you're riding it for that split second, and you fall flat on your face, and you kind of do the whole thing again.
To me, the best part is not the ride. It's the end of the ride where you get to fall into the water as per your own choice. You know, and you abandon your board. I love that. That's my favorite part.
Many times when you, when I look at what you create, and especially what you, you know, what you do on stage, you pick moments when you are at your most vulnerable.
Sure. Yeah.
Like, and also there's a deeper insight in all of those. Like, I remember watching that part about you getting beaten up in school.
In boarding school, yeah.
And I got beaten up in boarding school. And
but that's what boarding schools are for.
And it's always for the most random things.
Yeah.
But in your case, you did get up on stage and ask for it.
I till date, every beating I've gotten in my life, I've profoundly deserved. Some would say.
Mine was because I lost it with a senior in my first month of boarding school.
And it's a bad move.
Where he kept... Basically, I came from a very protected environment, and I was in a small town, and I was sent to this boarding school in Bangalore out of my own will of sorts. Or I wanted to go, so I went there. And I was this boy with a Telugu accent, but I still spoke English fluently, who didn't have the best sense of style. Or I did have the Shah Rukh Khan cool chain, which is a bad idea. Yeah, in hindsight, you don't go to boarding school wearing the cool chain. Yeah. Param kuchu jota hai. And then say something to a senior who makes fun of you to not get beaten up.
I think, but I mean, that's also one of the wonderful things about boarding school is it's democratizing in that sense, right? No matter where you're from or who your parents are, at least in my boarding school, same school uniform, same PT shoes, same, etc. So I think there's something healthy about that. But I do think some kids are meant to be institutionalized and some kids are not, right? I was the kid who, you know, mid-beating would be like, hey, what does this really accomplish? Thar, 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 thar. Does this make you feel better? Thar, 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 thar. You know, and at some point, you know, I talk about the beating in the special, but at some point, even the guy beating you would crack a smile, you know? And to me, till date, if we are fighting, like if my wife and I are in a fight or this thing, bro, if you crack a smile, fight's over. If I can make you laugh, fight's over. So if you're bullying me, and I can make you smile during that thing, you're no longer a bully. I've won. It doesn't matter how much you beat me. I've won.
Do you think that's what we don't realize about humor? Is that it's the most... I don't have the word for it. In every scenario in life, I feel humor does something that makes the sea calmer. If done right.
I don't know. I do believe that humor is, you know, it's pretentious to say that humor is a coping mechanism, you know, but it is a counter force that can be more unifying than forces of the world. You know, that's the way I look at humor. Like today, if right now in this studio there was an earthquake, you know, and all of us were a little bit terrified. And then suddenly the earthquake calmed down, right? And I just kind of looked at everybody and I was like, did anybody else shit their pants, right? And we all laughed instantly. That's a unifying counterforce to what we all just experienced, which was an undeniable force. And strangely, it would have brought us together more than the undeniable force. Like, that's how I view humor, you know?
I couldn't agree more, because we also assume that someone who's cracking a joke... I think cracking a joke and humor are two separate things.
Oh, very different things.
People always...
Stand-up comedy and telling jokes are two very different things often as well. Yeah.
How many times have you walked into a room and someone said, hey, you're a stand-up comedian, tell a joke.
No, yeah. Or use this joke. One guy walks into a bar, etc. I'm like, yeah, I'll do that at Siri Fort.
But it's... There's something about... that I'm going to that counterbalance piece you spoke about, right? Because... you believe that someone who's using humor as a mechanism is someone who isn't sure of themselves, but it's actually a a much softer way to deal with so many things than to go at it like smack.
But also, sometimes because we're in earlier comedy culture, at least for stand-up comedy specifically, we make the assumption that somebody is using humor, you know, when in fact somebody is really just experiencing humor, just like you are, you know. When you come to a show, I'm telling you a story, but I think analytically a lot of writers or journalists or critics or playwrights or filmmakers will question the purpose of telling that story, you know, or the intention of telling that story. Are you trying to make me laugh? Are you trying to make me uncomfortable? Are you sending me a message? Are you doing this? And when you really understand what my art form is, you'll understand that, bro, I'm just experiencing the story the same way you're experiencing. In a slightly more professional way, I'm experiencing it with you. It really is that base level, my art form of connection, you know.
One of my favorite stories, which I feel often pops up, even across what you share, is your journey through Bombay.
Yeah.
I feel everybody who's ever spent any time in Bombay has so many Bombay stories of just experiencing the city.
Yeah.
I was going through your Instagram. I was saying, let me find a few things which have resonated with me in the past. And this is one story you talk about walking in Bombay in the afternoons.
Yeah, man.
About how that is the most, that's the best time to walk through Bombay.
3:30 p.m. in Bombay. Yeah, it's great.
And why that resonated with me, it made me remember my early days in Bombay when I used to work at MTV, where around that time, 2-3 in the afternoon, when everyone's on like a semi-lunch break because everyone has lunch late, I would put on my headphones in Parel in Bombay and I would just go for a walk.
Yeah.
With no sense of which direction I'm walking, and I would just walk, and I would just let, and after that I'm not even listening to anything. I just had the headphones on. The headphones are generally like, you know, you don't come and talk to me. And I remember those walks so vividly because those were times when I experienced, you know, almost feel like the city takes you in, in so many ways. And so I remember reading that, I'm like, there's so many people who come to this city with so many things they want to do. And I think people come into cities to do all of that stuff. How did that experience change for you over time? Like,
I found, man, such immense kindness in this city. It is, and somewhere in that hour of the day, do you know what I mean? So I'm very emotional about it, but because it represents those connections to me. I remember I moved to Bombay on a whim. You know, I'd done a show for Times of India called the Times Food Awards. And I got put up at this Pali Hill guest house, right? And the awards went well. I was an MC, and Vineet Jain, who owns the Times of India, said, come to my office at VT station tomorrow morning. And I went there, and I think I had a 12 o'clock meeting. And he said, we think you have talent. We're going to sign you. We're going to make you a VJ. I'm like, great. What's a VJ? Right? I have no idea. And he's like, doesn't matter. You'll have to move to Bombay in 2 weeks. So I remember it being 3:30 p.m., right? And I've come back from town. I've taken a Kalipili back from town. I went to Marine Drive, smoked a cigarette, kind of looked out, had like my Shah Rukh Khan moment where I'm like, can I make it here? Took a Kalipili back. And I called my friend Yamini and I'm like, do you know a broker? And she's like, yeah, where do you want to live? And I'm like, I guess here, you know, wherever I am is very nice. And then I think at 3:45 p.m., a guy called Imtiaz came on a bike and picked me up from the Times of India guest house and took me to Russell Pinto's house in Bandra. And he's this doctor who had a room that was as big as this carpet, right? And I was like, can I live here? He's like, yeah, it's my annex. Do you do drugs? And I was like, no, sir. And he's like, cool, it's $5,000 a month, right? Or $5,500 a month. And it was literally, dude, it was like, my mattress was here, the front door was here, and it was gas stove, television, fridge, air conditioner, bathroom door. Was this wall, all of which I could touch with my feet. You know, so, and then to have the apartment not blow up, you had to turn the AC off while you turned the gas on. Like, you know, you had to do all of that stuff, etc. That was 3:30 p.m. I remember this gentleman called Ashwin Mushran, who I'm sure you know. There's a show called The Great Indian Comedy Show, right, which Ranveer Shore and Vinay Pathak and everybody were on. And it, you know, as a young comic, you're like, man, if I could just make it on that show, you know, and I had no agents or representation or anything like that. And the producer didn't like me very much. Right? He was like, this boy Shana is, English, privileged, etc., etc. So I was waiting for a 3-minute audition. And I think they made me sit outside the studio on a chair, on a plastic chair. And I remember Ashwin Mushran had come in and he was on the show. And I remember distinctly, like, he had an iPod, right, when the iPods had just come out. And I remember, like in slow motion, I can remember at, like, 3:45 p.m., Ashwin Mushran taking his iPhones off and, like, wrapping the iPhones around the iPod. And I was just thinking, man, that's a working actor. You know, like, that's what it means to be successful in Mumbai. The guy has an iPod, man. And I did this for 3 days, kind of sitting outside the studio. And then at some point, Mushran came up to me and he's like, bro, you shouldn't be sitting outside a studio in the sunlight. They'll either give you an audition or they won't, but go home. Don't embarrass yourself like this. And I'm like, but sir, I want to. And he's like, he pulled out his agent's card. And he's like, this is my agent. You give him a call and see if he'll represent you. Nobody does that, you know, but that's Mumbai. That agent signed me in 5 days and I had my first project in 7 days. And I didn't need to do the Great Indian Comedy Show, right? But I've just had these things that have happened should I tell you one more story or is this boring?
No, I love this story. Please go on.
I created this DVD called Viragra and I put it in DVD libraries all across Mumbai, right? My first movie, nobody knows about this movie at all. Most people think it was like Love Aajkal, where I was a background extra and all of that stuff. My first movie was a movie called Mumbai Salsa. All right.
How do I know that movie name?
Because it had a really good song called Let's Do the Mumbai Salsa, which Adnan Sami had sung, right? But it was this 6 friends ensemble and me and Manjari Fadnis were the young leads in this movie. And I remember I had gone to Vikram Bhatt's office at 2:30 p.m. And I'd taken an auto there and I was auditioning for like the 6th guy. They're going to find some hunk to be the lead guy opposite Manjari. And Manjari was cast already. And I'm like, sir, I gave an audition. And I'm like, sir, it's good to meet you. By the way, I do stand-up comedy. Here's my DVD. I remember heading back in an auto rickshaw at like 3:30 and getting a call from Vikram Bhatt on my cell phone, just being like, turn around and come back. You're a star. You're the lead of my movie. You know, so I turned around and went back to his office. And of course, Mumbai Salsa, right? So, you know, whatever happened, happened. But I've just had great 3:30 p.m.s in Mumbai where kindness has found its way to me.
Kindness is such an... You often told that being kind is something that can be a disadvantage, can be a negative thing for you because people take advantage of it.
Yeah.
But as you were telling me both these stories, one of the things that kept coming into my head was the fact that the more kind we are with each other, the more we let it flow. Yeah. Like, we all feel nicer, we all behave better, we all just kind of radiate the right kind of energy to each other. And things happen. Things will do well, not do well, but we'll all feel good.
Yeah, like, maybe sometimes I think of it like kindness exists and it's a lane of a highway that is going this way and it's always moving. Kindness is just on the move and it's your job to step into that traffic and kind of let it run you over and then step off when you need to. And the other lane is moving as well, but that one moves a lot faster, you know. So maybe it's not that you are kind or you feel kind or that maybe kindness just exists and for like fleeting moments of time, you let to get it pass through you, you know. But it is very purifying, tremendously.
Do you also feel that when you see kindness, it makes you be kinder as well? You need to kind of pay it forward. Is that something which do you feel happens naturally?
I think it's what God is, you know, like that is my version of God is an aspiration to kindness, you know, so it is everything to me, you know, it really is. And I definitely go through moments where like we both know people who have worked with me, right? So I'm an obsessive madman to work with, you know, in my madness, I can be incredibly unkind if we are not in a creative zone that I think we need to be, or we're losing our madness and we need to rally together and bring it back together. But I would count those moments as my biggest failures. To me, the biggest failures in my life are moments when I've been unkind, as opposed to moments where I've failed or succeeded at something, you know.
Do you have a way in which you move to correct it, or you just take the next?
I have this, it's very narcissistic, but I have a belief in instant karma. So I believe if I tell a lie this week, I will lose a project next week. If I fall sick, I can usually think of something I did 3 or 4 days ago. I'm like, so the minute something goes wrong in my life, I immediately kind of introspect and I'm like, fuck, I shouldn't have done that, right? But then you have to know where the limits are. You can't be like, yo, Donald Trump is president, it's because I told a lie last week, man. Like, you know, you can't be, that's self-indulgent also. But it's my own self-check, you know, to remind myself of what I've done wrong.
Is there a way you introspect regularly? Is that do you have a process?
I have not to sound like Oprah or whatever, but I have a gratitude thing in the morning, right? So I will wake up and I will take stock. Here are the things I'm very grateful for, so that I don't go into the day being a son of a bitch. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm like, I have to remind myself life's really, really good at the top of the day, and then go into the day. And then I think my writing is very introspective in that sense. Like, if you actually look at my stand-up comedy, across the board, it's about my failures. You know, I have yet to really talk about a success, you know. Even if I talk about like an Emmy nomination, or if I talk about, it is shitting on myself and it is how I failed during a big moment in my life. So I think that's my process. That's where I channel.
Like when you spoke about your Emmy nomination, that's interesting because you actually connected that to your Filmfare one and that still photograph, passport photograph rather. Yeah. And
But that is what comics do. Like I remember, like this is a really, it's a weird thing, right? These three things converged. I was in London when I found out that the Emmy nomination had happened. Right? But here's how it happened. This is a true story. And please forgive me if anybody's associated with these movies that I'm about to mention, etc., etc. And there's like a horror movie being made in India, right? And they wanted like this funny chokidar ka role, right? I think the movie is called Bhoot Police or something like that, right? And so I was in London and 2 days ago I got a call saying, do you want to be the chokidar in Bhoot Police? And I was like, I don't know. I'm going to be honest. I have no problem playing a chokidar, but what kind of chokidar? What is this thing, etc., etc.? And my management then called, and within 15 minutes, they were like, you've been nominated for an Emmy Award, but they do not think you are right for the chokidar from Bhoot Police. Right? And I was like, you know, life's all right. You know what I mean? Like, it's there are things to be grateful for here and things to amuse at as well.
It's almost like this. There's this whole thing about the universe shows you signs.
Yeah, oh, where to go?
Where to go? It's all saying, go there, don't go there. I'm still reacting to the
dichotomy of how different markets perceive you. Yeah, so am I, my man. So am I.
Do you also see yourself as? And I know there was the part with the Jupiter sand, I just love. I kept seeing that happen through the special, and I was like, spoiler alert for anyone.
No, I think by this point, you know, we can talk about it.
Do you think we misunderstand what being a global citizen is? Because you are, you function like that.
I do function like that. But I don't think I fully understood it either. You know, I would request the freedom to stumble through it and to figure it out. Because you must understand it, and not to toot my own horn or to, but I'm traversing a path that is kind of new. You know, not too many people, Priyanka, you know, has done it in her own way, but she's between two markets and two of the largest markets in the world. I'm really in a lot of places throughout the year, and it's very new. You know, for me, it's only been 4 years that I've really been able to do like a world tour. And so the fact that an Indian comic is able to perform for not just Indians everywhere, but people everywhere across the globe is a very new thing. So I don't have a handle on it yet, man. Like, I'm figuring it out. I really don't know, you know, to be honest. Like, I did 26 countries last year, maybe. 26 countries last year. There was 183 shows. So I saw the world. Like, literally the world. You know what I mean? Like, there's not a place I didn't see apart from, like, Iceland, Greenland, and, like, Antarctica, and South America I didn't do. I still haven't put it into context yet. You know what last year was. So I don't know what it means to be a global citizen.
Does it take away from what is home, do you think?
No, I'm very acutely aware of what is home, because I'm trying to put that on stage every day, you know. Whether we are in Oslo, whether we are in Perth, or whether we are in Mumbai, I'm taking you to Noida. You know what I'm saying? I'm very clear about that.
Because it's easy to lose that, right? Because I've noticed this. I have this standing joke about an aunt or a grand aunt, I forget who it was, who would suddenly develop an accent right after getting on an ISD call. For people to remember what ISD calls were, like, you do a call with someone in America, you suddenly start developing an accent. And I was like, you just been here.
To my credit, I've yet to do that, right?
Exactly. You've been going across.
To my credit, I've gone throughout the entire world. My accent has stayed the same.
Which is the thing. Which is for me the thing, is that our tendency is to, I think you want to seem like you are part of the space you're in.
But I think it's also there's psychological phonetics that have to do with it as well. Like, it is a thing. Like, Jerry Seinfeld used to have a great bit where he's like, you're in a taxi in France, right? And I'm butchering Seinfeld's bit like anybody would. And he's like, you tell the taxi, you're like, I'd like to go to the hotel, please. And the taxi guy's like, you know, he doesn't know. And for some reason, you put on a loud French accent, but still speaking, you're like, I would like to go to the hotel, please. Like, that's going to help. I think there's something psychological about it as well as humans. Like, I've certainly seen it in one of my closest friends, a big blonde white guy named Josh, who was my college roommate. And Indian girls around him were just like, Josh. And I'm like, Josh? It's Josh. What the f*** are you, you know, what are you doing? So, yeah.
The reason I asked about home and just staying, because I feel that one thing which we all look for more than ever as you get older is to feel a sense of being grounded. Because you want to feel like this is my space. And someone asked me when I turned 40 sometime late last year, and someone said, what are you looking for? I'm like, I'm just looking to have my routine be what, a few things in my routine not change. And it's just, and it feels like a very old person thing to say, but I'm like, I want to still be able to wake up and do X. It doesn't matter where in the world I am. Like, my mother judged me because I carried my coffee powder and my mocha pot with me when I went back home. And she's like, this is terrible. You come from the South, we make filter coffee. I'm like, no, I carried my mocha pot with me. And I feel that you realize that it's those small ordinary things that you carry with you no matter where you go in the world. And so you're carrying parts of your home with you. I know you carry a few things with you when you travel.
Yeah.
But are there a few things that are like home that you carry with you?
Yeah. I have a picture of my dog. His name is Dr. Watson. And that picture has been to more countries than most people. He's also embedded in the set of every Netflix special I've ever done.
No.
It's just a little Easter egg for me, but abroad understanding, losing it, Veerdas for India and this one, he's in the set. Like there's one picture of Watson in the set somewhere. You just have to kind of look for him.
I got to go back and look at it.
Yeah, and you'll see him. I have like a playlist that is constant for going to sleep and waking up, which is a little bit of like home music. Like I grew up between Africa and India, so everything from Yusuf Ndur to like Dil Se, you know, that kind of keeps me in this thing. My clothes are the same, so I'm not experiencing a lot of new stuff there. And that's it, man. But I'm also kind of fresh in this global phase. I've not been able to travel this much ever. So I'm, you know, like this year I'm acting a lot. So I'm going to be in one place a little bit. But like last year, I just didn't know where I was half the time.
There's also one relationship you speak about in the special, which is your relationship with the mic.
Yeah.
And how that's, like you said, that's the one thing you never want to be able to lose.
Yeah.
What do you think people get wrong about the relationship with being able to have a mouthpiece and have a mic?
Well, because there's so many different types of people that have a mic, you know, it's easy to confuse them when they reach a similar level of exposure. You know, a leader has a mic, a comedian has a mic, a singer has a mic. You know, a news anchor has a mic, and if they all are equally tracking on your social media and fed to you through one algorithm, and they're maybe all talking about the same things in the world, you will confuse these people for each other. It's human nature, you know, because sometimes a leader says something funny, sometimes a comedian says something serious, sometimes a singer song is about, you know, but that doesn't make a leader a comedian or a singer a politician. It's just visuals, you know, but I think the one thing that people get wrong about comedians on a mic, we don't care about anything but the laugh. Like you must be very clear about that with a comic. Like a doctor doesn't care about your feelings, he only cares about your health. Or a surgeon, she just cares that she needs to remove the, I just care about the laughs. So whatever you tell me is funny, I will do more of that. And whatever you tell me is not funny, I will do more of that. And there's nothing that anybody can say to us that is worse than your silence. And there's nothing that anybody can say about us that we haven't said about ourselves. We care that much about the laugh, you know? So a lot of times people are like, comedians want to make a statement or they want you to feel a certain way. No, I just want your laughter. That's all I care about.
If you had to kind of go back to when you first held that mic,
yeah.
Do you have a piece of advice for yourself?
I mean, I got my ass whooped the first time I held a mic, right? Like, I beat the shit out of me. Do push-ups? I don't know. No, man. Like, I don't say this with arrogance, but I was born on a stage. I really was. Like, ever since I was 3.5 years old, if you put me on a stage, I'm home. You know, if it's music or dramatics or debating or what's the good word or quizzing or comedy, if I was on a stage, I was just home. And I still can't explain why. It feels like home.
And you had points of, like, self-doubt that kind of made you question that sometimes?
Which weekday would you like? You know what I mean? Like, that's the process, right? It's the self-doubt that makes you question yourself. But I'd still rather work it out on stage, you know?
And I brought up self-doubt because it's one of the topics we speak about the most on this show.
Yeah.
Right? Because I feel the two things you realize the audience is always asked about, which interestingly is confidence,
yeah,
and self-doubt. It seems to be the most universal thing that everyone is battling with in their heads. And I realize everybody has a slightly different system to kind of fluctuate from one to the other. Do you have a system? How do you get back from self-doubt to confidence?
I don't think I make it back often. But I will take self-doubt and I will open it up to the world and I will talk to the world about it. And perhaps I'm not able to remove mine, but if I'm able to remove theirs, I feel slightly more confident about myself. Does that make sense? It sounds very convoluted, but...
No, it makes total sense because it's easier to... I mean, this is thing I read the other day and it took me some time to like... Initially, I was like, this is just fluff. But then I thought about it. Like, it's easier for most of us to give advice than to take our own.
Yeah.
And I thought about that a few times. Same way, it's easier for you to help someone else deal with their own self-doubt than for you to directly deal with your own. And I think that circle back to you might take a little longer. And that's what I got from what you just said.
Yeah, like, I think I spoke about this on another podcast. Forgive me if it's repeating something, but like, I had a profound moment where, like, there's a college kid in the front row. And typically you'll shit on a young kid in the front row being like, oh, Papa bought the tickets, right?
Hmm.
My front row is expensive. You know, if you come to my show, it will go everywhere from like $5,000 to $500 so that everybody can attend the show. But then usually younger people are in the back because they don't have $5,000 to spend. And so there's like a 19-year-old in the front row. And I'm like, Papa bought the tickets. And I think she was like, no, the two of us, we've saved 4 months for this. And I was like, well, what did you save on? She's like, we skipped lunch. You know, we'd skip lunch 3 days a week in the canteen.
What do you say to that?
What do you say to that, right? So at that moment, you forever decide, you're like, listen, I'm a mess. I'm a complete mess. I'm very far from having my shit together. But from now and forever on, when you walk into this room, we'll forget about your mess. You know what I mean? Like, you will forget about your mess. So I'm not going to preach to you about how to get your life together or that I have my life together, etc., etc., etc. But I'm going to focus on like making you feel better about your mess, not making me feel better about mine on stage, you know?
Which is what I believe most people get wrong about the power of the internet, is that you're sharing your mess.
Yeah.
So people can also feel like they're not the only ones who have a mess.
Yeah.
Or are the only ones dealing with it. But what we end up doing is we try to show that we don't have a mess and that I just woke out of bed like this and I have a life like this, but everything is a mess off camera. But it's actually the flip that we're supposed to do.
Yeah, like, you know, I'm doing this new bit and I'm in a terrifying phase right now where a special just came out, so I have no new material, right? So I'm just throwing darts at a wall and writing new stuff, but it's about me being 43 and realizing I'm really not an adult. And that fame has kind of cushioned me from adulthood. And then as you get older, it catches up with you, right? Like, I remember I had this 1 month where I was dealing with some finance stuff and I was dealing with some legal stuff and I was dealing with a bunch of just adulting things, right? Which is what life is, dealing with shit like this. And I had to call people for help and advice, etc., etc. And then I'm like, everybody who I'm calling is my age or younger than me, right? And all of them are like, yeah, I'll call my guy. And I'm like, I don't have a guy. I have zero guys, you know, and I don't have any of this knowledge as well. I'm not a f***ing adult. And I need to be. I need to grow up a little bit because I can't keep calling 38-year-olds to sort my life out, you know. And I put that out on stage. And, you know, it comes from a place of, oh, fame. Like, if you look at it one way, you're like, oh, it's a guy complaining about his fame, right? But if you look at it another way, which is what you're talking about, people are going, man, I don't have my shit together either, you know. But this guy seems to be in a more messy place than I am, so I feel slightly better. Those are the two ways to look at that statement, you know?
And at some point when you start observing people and their actual sense, you see so many interesting things that you wouldn't normally see.
Yeah.
It's like one of my favorite pastimes, and it still continues to be, is that I know you do this, easiest place is an airport, but in general, anywhere, observe what people do.
Oh yeah, man.
And there is so much there. Like your recent one about that kid, Terry.
Yeah, who's
oh my God, a legend. Like the fact that, and if someone hasn't seen it, you should definitely go like check that one. I won't tell that story, right? Yeah. But it's just that you see people do things and like, A, that is genius, or like, that is so fun, or even if it's weird, it's a good kind of weird, because weird is always interesting.
Yeah, but I think the one thing with the internet, though, is it has exposed us to how funny people are. You know, the internet is undefeated, you know, at the end of the day. Like, it has all the receipts, and the internet is funny as hell, you know. And I think that's what I love about it. Like, my favorite things on the internet are just people being funnier than all the comics I know. You know, people being funnier than all the celebrities I know. That's what I love about it. People are weird as hell, man.
I found this Instagram account yesterday. These two women run an art studio. I don't know where, because I haven't even checked that. And they always have paint and stuff all around. But all their videos are them playing random music, dancing like complete dogs. And one of them keeps flinging her chappals, like her flip-flops. And half the time that flip-flop is flying and breaking something off camera.
That's great.
And I'm like, I want to watch every video. It doesn't matter if it's about art. This is what it is.
And so I think this girl was from Korea or something like that. But I found this Instagram account where very sweet girl, right? Lady, I don't know, 26, 25 years old. Very sweet. Will look into camera. Bring a piece of bread or a loaf of bread, put it into frame, and smash her face into the bread, right? And she does this with different breads. So she does it with sourdough, with wheat bread. She just smashes her face into bread. It's the most compelling thing I've ever seen, man. I'm like, she knows it's hilarious. I know it's hilarious. This is great. Like, you know, but imagine the, like, comedians like to be like, mera pain, mera struggle, mera ye. Can you imagine what it takes to be like, yo, I think I'm going to smash my face into bread
every day.
Put myself out there like that? That shit is scary.
It's like that, there was that chicken fried rice guy, right?
Yeah.
For a while.
Baba Sehgal? No, sorry.
Close enough.
Yeah.
I have many Baba Sehgal stories.
But Baba Sehgal is yet another example.
Legend, right?
Where purity of intention knows that half the people that are watching him are watching him artistically, and half the people that are watching him for fun.
Those music videos are the best thing to have hit the internet.
It's amazing.
You recently said that you've taken a period of switching off.
Yeah.
What do you do when you switch off, apart from coming for podcasts?
I'm writing right now. So I'm writing. I'm just in a phase in my life where the next three things I'm acting in, I'm writing, you know, and I was like, I just need to take off social media glasses. You know, part of the theme of my special, you know, was when you are the center of, you are the storm in a teacup, you know, kind of like the center of the universe on social media, or at least you feel that way. And then suddenly you turn your phone off and you discover that, no, it wasn't half as big as you thought it was. And you weren't half as, it was love. And you didn't see it because immediately around you in this social media bubble was hate. But there was this sea of love that you just couldn't see. And that had a profound effect on me. I'm like, you know, at some point I think I caught myself where I was like, oh, the last two things I wrote about were like Twitter things. You know, and Twitter things aren't real things. Let's be honest about that. Twitter things are great recall because we're all talking about them, but they're not real things. You know, it's like I need to let life happen a little bit. So I'm saying yes to things, you know, catching up with my wife. She's great, you know, and I'm trying to figure out what my next creative emotion is for a show. And that and I'd like it to be as non-digital as possible.
Someone told me the other day that don't get a frame of reference for everything you create from the internet, because then you're just repeating what someone else said. And I realized I had the tendency to do that a lot more. So I'm going through a period of not creating as much of the non-podcast stuff, because I'm just like letting, like you said, like life happen off screen. And
but also I think it's a double-edged sword, right? Where for various reasons, in the last year of my life, my audience has grown tremendously. some because of notoriety, some because of of work, some because of etc. So now I just have a lot of people coming to see me, and a very diverse range of people coming to see me. And so all of a sudden, like, you know, if you go up and you're like, did you read that shit on Twitter? 40% of the audience are like, no, man, like, we have kids, and we have bills and we have a life and we work at Microsoft, etc. Like, no, we didn't read this thing on Twitter. You're still going to make us laugh? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I still do, you know. So I think that it's also par for the course with getting a broader audience. You're like, I need to get into real life a little bit more.
Is there a piece of advice you got through this entire journey that stays with you?
My father is amazing that way, because my father has the ability to assume the best about everyone and every situation until they prove him wrong, you know? And so he just kind of said, don't take anything personally, you know? And sometimes that is the antithesis of what you do as an artist. I take everything personally, you know? And he's like, no, let it affect you. Let it imbibe things in you, but don't take it personally. You know, everybody's going through their own thing. So I take that from him.
No, I can go on, but we have this rule on the show, which is the fact that once you hit close to a little over an hour,
yeah. We
leave it at a point where the audience wants more, and
okay. To
hopefully get a guest back sure. At some point of time to continue this and extend this conversation further. Thank you so much for doing this.
This was fun, man. It was a great conversation.
Thanks so much for coming.